This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I want to say this is so overwhelming to see you all here and to share my work. And I actually couldn't sleep last night because I said I have to convince him how important sociology is as a discipline. But also, there's one thing I want to get across, if there's anything that I get across in this talk, about how much I love what I do and telling and capturing people's stories. The title of this talk is called How I Learned What I Learned, Using Interaction Orders to Study Troubled Interactions. And it's an homage to August Wilson, an American playwright who had this century series. There was a play for every decade from 1900 all the way until 1990. And before he died, he wrote one play called How I Learned What I Learned, a one-man show, to describe how he studied the world. And what I wanted to do with this talk is share my journey of becoming a sociologist, but also the types of stories and the work that I'm interested in. Now, I want to explain something so we know where I got how I learned what I learned from. But studying interaction orders, or using interaction orders to study inequality, and particularly troubled interactions. And troubled interactions are these things where communication falls apart and we speculate about motives. And so sometimes we can repair and fix the miscommunication. You know, I was joking earlier that, you know, for a lot of people, they can't call me Waverly. They call me Wesley, they call me Avery, and I can correct them. They're like, no, my name is Waverly. But then there are times where the communication is so abstract and we don't have a time to fix it, and we speculate why that communication fell apart. And these other books are sociological classics. And these books were really trying to understand not only the social order of communication, but also people who have marginalized identities, how we make sense of different definitions of the situation, you know, how an individual experienced something where a whole population experienced something very similar, but also how people are stigmatized and the speculation about the media and the future. Now, I have been doing this teaching for over 24 years, and I think there are three things that I want to get across in this talk. I want to talk about the origins of sociology and why I became a sociologist. I'm going to share some of my research, and if there's enough time left, I'm going to talk about my future projects. So, sociology as a discipline has a long history of being concerned with inequality. And before a lot of the state programs like a Social Security or health insurance or a safety net, a lot of wealthy philanthropists paid for research to understand how we were transitioning from agricultural to an industrial society. And one of those philanthropists was Frederick Engels, who wrote a book called The Conditions of the Working Class in England in 1844. And this book is magnificent because it captures the horrendous conditions of early factories in the 1800s, from child labor to the exploitation of both women, men, and children. But what Engels wanted to bring attention to is the way that this new labor form was sort of stripping people of their humanity. And this tradition continued, not only with philanthropists, you know, investing in this work. W.B. Du Bois, one of the most premier and highly regarded sociologists in the country, who shaped my career, did a similar study in Philadelphia called the Philadelphia Negro that was paid for by Joseph and Susan Wharton. And what W.B. Du Bois wanted to do was to sort of illustrate how people who had just, you know, were formerly enslaved, moving from chattel slavery in Philadelphia, how they were faring. And what Du Bois captured was that there were a number of things going on. In addition to trying to identify ways that we can help people, he also pointed out that there was a preference for immigrant labor over black labor. But these studies about working class people in London, blacks in Philadelphia, Charles Booth did a similar study about, you know, the conditions in London as a city, and Jane Addams. And so as a sociologist, you can imagine me, who's committed to, you know, trying to understand social problems, both on the macro level, but how people make sense of it as an interactionist. Which brings me to the methodology that I use. I'm an urban ethnographer. And what that pretty much means is that I use a toolkit of qualitative methods, field work, observation, participant observation, to understand people's everyday lives. And this tradition actually comes from one of the founders of American sociology, Robert Park. Now, I'm gonna put on my magical glasses so I can read this, because this transition of sociologists using ethnography happened very early in the 1900s. And ethnography was the bedrock method of anthropologists. But Park was like, we should use this method to study everyday life of different populations in the United States. And what's different about ethnography and sociology as opposed to anthropology or other disciplines, it's not only our theoretical traditions are different in terms of how we make sense, but also the relationship to other methods. And what's different about sociology compared to anthropology at the time is that Park and his students, he was suggesting that we should study people in proximity to us instead of studying people abroad in other locations and places. And so Park, you know, suggests the same patient methods of observation which anthropologists like Boas and Louis have extended on the study of life and manners of the North American Indian might be more fruitfully employed in the investigation of customs, beliefs, social practices, and the general conceptions of life prevalent in Little Italy or the lower north side of Chicago, or recording the more sophisticated folkways of inhabitants of Greenwich Village and the neighborhood of Washington Square. But this is my origin story as a sociologist. And these studies humanize so many people on the margins. The Jack Roller is about a young kid from the age of 6 all the way up into his early 20s on how he navigated being a thief and arrested, and how this study, very early on in the late 20s, impacted the way that our juvenile justice system had, you know, housed both juveniles and adult offenders. The Taxi Dance Hall humanized people on the margin, women of color, immigrant women, who worked in something that we would call sex work. But how did these people on the margins navigate the world? Other books normalized immigrant populations, from Polish immigrants who were coming in the late 1800s and moving into cities, but also Eastern European Jews, and so the Polish peasant, the gold close in a slum, and we even did it for Black Americans and Italian Americans, so Black Metropolis, Street Corner Society, and these were all these books that sort of came out of that tradition. But what is this about troubled interaction? As people are moving and trying to figure out how we relate to each other, what holds us together, a number of sociologists speculated about this world that we're in. Post-World War II, over 90 million people died. European academic institutions were devastated. And the American academic institutions rose to prominence. And a lot of sociologists were trying to figure out what's going to hold us together as a society. A society that's so different, but has a multitude of stories from people from every part of the world. And the reason I use ethnography in my work is to tell those stories. Your story, and I'm borrowing this from Flannery O'Connor and my mentor, Elijah Anderson, who's an ethnographer, is the one true thing. You are expert on your experience. And what I love about ethnography is using my field work to explore community, to investigate why things like drug dealing or food insecurity or access to healthcare is marginalized. I want to illustrate these stories for a wider audience. And sometimes I want to examine if some of our policies and ideas are working. But here, my work deals with, you know, inequality. I study inequality in neighborhood and institutional settings. So everything from neighborhood poverty, policing, and drug dealing, to interactions troubled by race and racism, and to food apartheid, looking at the entire food system, Or a clinic where children who are verbally fluent, high-functioning kids who receive the autism diagnosis, how they navigate the world. But I want to show how these people who live in these communities are natural experiments where they make the social order of their worlds visible. And to understand this, if we understand the sense-making, the policies, how people interact, maybe we can have more fruitful interventions. Now, in all of those broad ways of me studying autism, food insecurity, inequality, I have a methodological sort of way I think about these problems or issues, but I also have a theoretical orientation called the interaction order that was first presented by Irvin Goffman in 1983 during his presidential address. And Goffman says, interaction orders are relatively autonomous orders of practice regulated by shared presuppositions and conventions. And the reason I'm doing that voice is I remember reading this definition for the first time, and I was like, what? But it's about local relationships, learned behavior, commonly recognized practices, how we have a shared expectation, you know, how time works, time to do the activity, time of day, our social constructions around time. And then thinking about how people are punished and rewarded for doing a particular behavior. And this isn't about right or wrong, but just understanding how people make sense, how they take those ideas for granted, but also what causes these relationships to fall apart. Now, remember I told you your story is the one true thing. I don't believe anyone starts at a blank slate. I am a descendant of American slaves, farmers, and factory workers. I come from a working class background. And that upbringing shaped my sensibilities. You know, I still, you know, can point out that these are my, you know, great grandparents from the 1840s. And that's their son in the middle. And then there's my grandma. And because we all have the same nose, I just started to put a picture of my mom as we were looking forward. But it is to capture this American story. You know, Henry Ford sent emissaries to Mississippi to recruit workers to work in the factory. And my uncle and aunt were the first two people to move to Detroit to work in the factory. And that factory no longer exists today. And those are my uncle and aunt and my mom and my uncle today. But these are my parents, you know, who moved to Detroit after Martin Luther King was assassinated from Mississippi for a better life. And these are their kids. They had 8 children. If I told you my grandparents had 13 kids on my mom's side, but they're descendants of farmers. And now we're moving to factory workers. But I come from a military family. And all of these sensibilities of why I became a sociologist was shaped by deindustrialization and what happened to my neighborhood in Detroit. And pointing out that deindustrialization is sort of an incomplete story. In one instance, it was watching the auto industry go through a decline, then watching other industries adjacent to the auto industry, glass, rubber factories, move out of the city to the south and then abroad. But the devastation that it left, this is the neighborhood where I grew up in Detroit. You can still see this on a map if you Google 8499 Lyford Street. This neighborhood doesn't exist anymore. Or it doesn't exist in the way that I remember it as a child. And this is what it looks like today. And this is my elementary school and my middle school. And so I'm trying to figure out how did this happen. And what I discovered, in addition to deindustrialization, that the introduction of crack cocaine just reshaped the trajectory of the neighborhood where I grew up. And so my first book was one where I never thought anybody would read this book. I just wanted to tell a story of resilience. I found a community that was very similar to the one where I grew up that had an embedded drug scene, but the houses were still standing and the people still lived there. And I wanted to know what was different about this community compared to mine. Why did this community survive and the one where I grew up no longer existed? And sort of understanding the rules by asking people the questions like, how do you make sense? what do you do? What does it mean to have community in this place? And using that interaction order to tell the history, the biography, but also things about who can tell the story, you know, becomes really important. And so I circle back, and what I discovered is that people have an expert knowledge. You know, where I grew up, the drug was crack cocaine. Compared to this neighborhood, it was powdered cocaine. When I was growing up, I didn't witness all the transformations related to welfare reform, housing reform, the transition from livable wages, public education, all of those things. But people in these communities knew exactly what they were experiencing. And what I wanted to do was to illustrate that expert knowledge that people had based on the interaction order that existed in that community, where there could be different definitions of the situation. What I discovered in this space after spending several years there was that it wasn't this easy story to be told. The dealers, the residents, the children, the school teachers, everybody was under pressure. And that pressure created social situations where people did things that they wouldn't normally do if they had better opportunities. I want to play a clip from one of the residents, and the transcript should pop up, but to give you this sort of expert knowledge of how people make sense of this neighborhood that had an embedded drug scene, but also the contradiction of how residents viewed these young people.
You read the paper about these guys out there selling the drugs and all that kind of stuff, and you think they're bad guys. Well, some of them are. Some of them are. But when you belong to that world, you know, now I don't, like I said, I don't sell drugs, I don't do drugs, but I'm in the world with them. You know, this is their world. Well, they kind of cover their world. If I go down, guys on the corner could be selling drugs. Be a million out there. If I fall down the middle of the street, you guys are going to make sure I'm okay. And that's the hard part. No, I don't want to see them selling drugs. No, I definitely don't want to see them selling drugs. And if there was some kind of magic wand that I could take, I'd take it. None of them would sell drugs. And my magic wand would be to get rid of all the people that took drugs. Because if you get rid of all the people that take drugs, there ain't no reason for the person to sell drugs. But I also see the way this system runs. I've had people get felonies for selling drugs. And then they come over and knock on the door after they get out. I don't know why, but after they get out, they got to come here and explain to me what happened. Am I lying there? They got to knock on this door and explain to me what happened. Well, let me tell you, Mr. Tom, we don't want you mad. It's like, hey, you know, it is what it is. Anything I can do, and I tell them the same thing. Anything I can do, let me know. And they said to me, well, do you know anybody hire? Then you go out there and you look around. Try and get them a job. And not all these ten places around here tell you, oh, there is no jobs. They got a felony. Cadets, they got a felony. Can't hire them. Then that same guy who just got out of jail 2 months ago, he has a family. It might not be, you know, wife and you know, the regular family, but he has kids or whatever, needs a place to stay. What does he do? He goes right back to selling drugs. That hurts. That hurts, right?
And so putting out and understanding the contradictions that exist in these spaces, that in one instance, there's this drug trade that people see in their community, know nothing about, that has its own rules, but also their rules of what it means to be a member in this community. And sometimes we have two different definitions of the situation, where there's a working consensus for how, when you're in these spaces, how you're supposed to behave and what the expectations are. And sometimes, you know, we have different definitions of the situation. And how do we reconcile that trouble? Tacit racism. After I worked on No Way Out, my co-author and I, the brilliant Ann Rawls, decided, you know, that we wanted to show and illustrate that even in miscommunication or troubled interactions around issues of race, you know, how do we make the ordinary strange and make that hyper-visible to show that people are doing things that they're not conscious of? And so this is a book that looks at how we come and understand notions about race. How is race socially constructed? The historical meanings of race and this category of whiteness. And what I mean by category of whiteness, these categories change over time, about who inhabits these categories and who doesn't. You know, and then theories of race and racism and implications for people who experience racial discrimination. What happens if a doctor doesn't take your pain seriously? What happens if there's miscommunication with law enforcement? What happens, you know, when you're trying to advocate for your family and, you know, whether it's housing, whether it's healthcare, whether it's education, and you're seen as a category and people are speculating about your motives? And what we wanted to do was to make it very clear that in one instance, you know, we're all humans, Homo sapiens with sprinklings of Neanderthal DNA. Ancestry is where we come from, you know, locations. Like, this is my 23andMe, and I'm, you know, 82% Sub-Saharan African, 16% European, 1.4 East Asian Native American. But these categories are where people are right now, you know. But yet, I identify as a Black American. There's a recognition of that. And so teasing these things out, but also explaining that these are life and death consequences based on misunderstandings that have implications for all of us. The next project was about food apartheid. And while I'm using the term food apartheid, I want to bring attention to the entire food system. But I also want to talk about displacement. This project about food insecurity takes place in the East Liberty section of Pittsburgh. And this sign by a famous artist from Carnegie Mellon, who's now a famous artist on their own terms, Alicia Wormsley, put up this sign in Pittsburgh, "There are Black people in the future," because displacement was happening so rapidly, first in the business district, then in the neighborhoods. And what she wanted to do, I speculate because I read interviews, I don't have to speculate, was to reaffirm that the people were being displaced, that they were going to be okay. You know. But what this sort of triggered was me systematically studying this neighborhood and discovering that people have been displaced over multiple generations. You know, those migrants who moved, very similar to my family, you know, settled in the Hill District in Pittsburgh. And then urban renewal destroyed a huge section of that neighborhood and displaced people to the neighborhood where that sign went up. I wanted to bring attention to uneven development. You know, I'm studying food apartheid, but what if I told you in this neighborhood there are 7 supermarkets within a quarter mile radius of each other? And they're all thriving. And even in the face of this overwhelming access to food, you still have people who are experiencing health disparities, you still have people who are being displaced, and you still have people who are experiencing food insecurity. So how do we make sense of uneven development? And again, how do we have a deeper understanding about what's going on in these communities, even in the face of having access to food? What's preventing people from entering those spaces? And then clashing interaction orders. Are these things about what happens whereas the businesses are taken off, and then the neighborhoods, as people who come in and look around and shop at these various stores, decide that they want to live in this space and start buying up houses. And then the people who live there and the new people who move in this neighborhood, you know, don't recognize each other. And what do you do in those situations? But it also made me think about how do we think about gentrification as something that happens over time. What about displacement and resettlement? How do we think about the people who are in these spaces, but the people who are no longer in these spaces? And one of the things that residents suggested that if they had political representation and property ownership, they could have prevented this from happening. I want to share one clip from a film by a snippet of a film of a resident in this community highlighting how she's systematically pushed out of her neighborhood. This is a clip by Chris Ivey, a brilliant filmmaker in Pittsburgh who I'm working with, and I just want to capture this one moment to highlight the story.
Nation, we had African Americans who supported us. We have Caucasian, we had Indians, everyone, and I loved it because everyone came as soon as they came in. We never knew them from a can of beans, but instantaneously, we were like family. And my customers were so awesome. We had a flood in 2015 in March. That flood devastated the whole of downstairs where there was no bathroom at all. How embarrassing it is for customers to come in, oh, you know, you can sit and eat, but there's no bathroom for you to use. He's not fixing the bathroom. Almost a year, there is no bathroom for my customers to use at all. But he wants 100% of the rent, and then he wants to raise the rent by $500 more. Then he's writing me some kind of memorandum that, oh, well, I'm gonna raise the rent to $2,000 or so dollars or whatever. Can you handle that? What about the bathroom? You have not installed a bathroom. My customers, I had a customer, she's from Italy. Her family's from Italy. Mom, dad, everyone is coming down. Cecilia, you wanna make a reservation? I said, babe, we have no bathroom for you guys to use. They came anyway, sat there for 3-4 hours, no bathroom. I felt this small. And I tell you, I kid you not, how should I say this? I'm a lover of people. Even though we were there to serve food, it was more than food, it was love. We were just so happy to see where we could have gone as a family, as a business. This man crushed our dreams so badly. I felt when people were telling me, I want to get out of Pittsburgh, I don't like Pittsburgh, I'm like wondering why. I couldn't understand it. And just from being in that place of business, I understand why some people wanted to get away from Pittsburgh. A lot of them got away for many years, and some came back. And you wonder why they came back? A sense of family. This is where they were born, and they want to see something happen in this location. Now, it devastated us. At first, I told my husband, I said, oh, everything's going to be all right. But financially, it is devastating right now to have car payments coming in. You can't pay this. This is coming in camp. Everything is devastating. And this man has so much money. Here it is. He had some workers because he had to contract people. He had some workers come in. It's a group of white guys and stuff like that. And I tell you, they tell me everything. They say, you know what? He told us to do this and this to you guys. And we told him, no, we're not going to do that to you. He didn't specifically say what, but I knew it was no good. And he said, they said to him, no, we're not going to do that to them. They don't deserve that. Now, you put a camera in the back of the window in the backyard where my kitchen goes, but you can't fix my bathroom? I tell you, I told him, I said, with you, I said, I've gotten a glimpse of racism, what it means to be a slave, to be enslaved. However, that one man will not change my love for humanity. A lot of things that are happening in Pittsburgh.
Now, my future work is, the next project I'm working on is looking at autism and how kids who are high-functionally verbally fluent kids on the spectrum talk about emotions. But what I want to say to you all, as an ethnographer, your story and the stories of people is the one true thing. And this is why I love what I do, and this is just a snapshot of my research. I hope you got something out of it. But thank you for this opportunity to share, and I hope these stories resonate with you. And now I'll take questions.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.